Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I was just 20. They were mostly women my mother's age. They were saying my mother and my grandmother, so I guess many of the recipes would have been from the 19th century.
Thanks to food historians like Claudia Roden, people are still making those recipes today. I speak with her about the joys and difficulties of documenting family food traditions. These days, corn is harvested with the help of machines. Husking by hand has become sort of a sport in some places. Harvest Public Media delves into that. It's Corn O'Clock with Chef Bob Adkins and blogger Amy Jeanroy. We grill it, make a sauce for it, and then preserve it, and make your own cheese. Robin Morton shows us how simple it is to whip up some paneer. Mark Chilla with a snapshot of the week's food and ag news.
California isn't the only state suffering from drought. Washington, a state known for its verdant landscape, is suffering from a lack of snow, not rain. The rare drought has caused worry among farmers, as uncharacteristically hot, dry weather has dried up rivers and streams. The drought is the worst the state has seen since 1977, when the state's farmers saw a 2.5% decrease from the previous year due to harsh conditions. Not all farmers are staying up at night, though, fretting over lack of rain. Fruit farmers and farmers dependent on irrigation have fared better than expected, and others affected by the drought believe it's merely a low point in a long career. The state has put $16 million into funding through 2017 to help keep the rivers flowing and agriculture moving along as expected. The cities of Seattle, Tacoma, and Everett have put into place a voluntary water reduction call, asking residents to cut water usage by 10%. Midwest farmers have reached a milestone in the recovery from a massive avian flu outbreak last spring. Birds are back in the barns at a turkey operation in northwest Iowa. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
Brad Moline says his farm had a few advantages when it came to disposing of turkey carcasses and ridding his barns of the flu virus. For one, he says they became infected late in the outbreak once officials had procedures in place.
We weren't forced to be delayed by any reason from the U.S. government or the Iowa government. The second thing is we have a unique advantage on this farm, and probably the most important reason is on this farm, we do all of our own work.
Moline says that means they had the equipment and personnel they needed to get the barns cleaned and disinfected quickly. U.S. Department of Agriculture officials say they expect most farms throughout the hardest-hit states of Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota to be back in business by the fall. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Food and agriculture titans are looking more and more to add aquaculture to their operations as global demand for fish increases and fish farming overtakes wild ocean fishing as the preferred way to put fillets on the table. But as online news site Quartz reports, more fish farms mean more demand for wild fish like sardines and anchovies to turn into fish meal. Agriculture heavyweight Cargill has bid $1.5 billion to purchase a Norwegian salmon feed supplier. The number of wild-caught fish has leveled off over the last few decades due to concerns about overfishing and more strict management of fisheries. But intensive harvesting of little fish like anchovies can ravage ocean ecosystems. The Food and Agriculture Organization predicts that the world will produce more fish from farming than in the wild by 2023. And crop insurance claims have jumped due to wet weather in the Midwest and dry weather elsewhere, according to Bloomberg News Research. Bloomberg found claims so far have jumped 48% from last season. Corn has been the hardest hit crop, with corn farmers filing claims on 2.3 million acres. Analysts generally agree the output will be reduced overall for 2015, but many are cautious when discussing the report, noting the crop season isn't over yet. The tough weather and increased claims have led companies like Wells Fargo to consider selling off their stake in crop insurance. Share these stories on your Facebooks, your Twitters, and your emails. They're all posted at eartheats.org.
Tell us what stories were on your radar this week. Tweet us at eartheats. Mark Chilla, till next time.
See you soon, Annie.
It's harvest time, and that means farmers all over the Midwest are bringing in billions of bushels of corn, With modern technology, they can strip acres in a day. But corn used to be harvested by hand. And Abby Wendell went to the one place where that kind of technology isn't obsolete for this encore presentation by Harvest Public Media.
Frank Hennenfent stands like an athlete. His feet apart, knees bent, back firm, he's squared off against a field of corn.
7, 6, 5.
As the announcer counts down, he takes hold of his first ear.
1. Begin.
Hennenfent begins picking the corn with his hands. He slices through the corn husk with a hook that's attached to his palm with a leather strap. Then he snaps the golden ear off its stalk and tosses it over his shoulder into a wagon following alongside him. Most days, Hennenfent is a typical Illinois farmer. At this time of year, that means he drives an air-conditioned, GPS-equipped combine, a machine that can harvest as many as 12 rows of corn at a time. But today, Hennenfent is going back to the basics. He's a top competitor at the 34th annual Illinois State Corn Husking Competition.
When I pick corn, I totally lose myself in it.
As he makes his way down the row, corn flies through the air. He's establishing his beat.
Just kind of get that rhythm and that place where you're in a trance and that's all you're thinking about. And you don't really hear anybody around you or anything. It's just next ear, next ear, next ear.
The contest is held in a cornfield in Roseville, a rural community in western Illinois. It's one of several competitions happening at this time of year across the Midwest. Here, about 250 people have come from as far away as the suburbs of Chicago to watch. Grade schooler Sam Monroe says she's here specifically to see Frank Hennenfent.
He lives just right across the field from us, and my dad says that I have to be trained by him and so I can enter the competition next year.
There are several races throughout the day, ranging from two-minute-long peewee contests for the kids to 20-minute matches for those 50 and up.
Pull it down. Now, don't drop that hand. Just hold on to that husk.
In preparation for the 50 and up event, a group of men lean in to watch Dick Humes. He's giving them a last-minute lesson.
See there?
Down. I'm still not getting it.
Some of Humes' students remember a time when harvesting corn by hand wasn't a sport. It was a way of life. Don McKinley grew up in the 1930s in southwestern Iowa on a farm with 100 acres of corn. During the harvest, McKinley would drop out of school for 2 months to help his older brothers and dad. The five men picked from before sunup till after dark.
Now as I look back, Mom and Dad never had any worry about the kids running around at night. We were so damn tired you couldn't... We'd just fall over into bed and collapse, get up the next morning, do it all over again.
He says each of them brought in about 4,500 pounds a day. That's a lot of corn. Still, McKinley's run the numbers, and they show that a man simply can't compete with a machine. In 1937, John Deere came out with a number 10 corn picker that picked as much as 4 Don McKinley's. And today, a big combine like the one a typical Illinois farmer uses brings in close to 200,000 pounds an hour. You would need an army of over 2,000 men to keep up.
And that's in my lifetime. In my lifetime. 10 bushel an hour working your butt off. To sitting in that cab, going through your field and shelling 4,200 bushel in an hour. Now that's evolution. That's... My dad would turn over in his grave if he knew that there was a machine that could pick that much.
Back in the cornfield, Frank Hennenfent is finishing his race. He made it farther down the row than anyone else, and he's attracted a crowd. Ardith Claire watches in awe.
It doesn't seem like he's hurrying. I mean, he's got one hit in the bumper board, one in the air, and he's got his hand on the third one. And he's just like a machine.
By the end of his race, Hennenfent had picked 450 pounds of corn in 20 minutes. It might not be good enough to compete with John Deere, but it will take him to the national competition held later this month in Iowa. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
This story originally aired last year in October. The 35th annual Illinois State Corn Husking Contest will take place this year on Sunday, September 27th. More stories from America's fields from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. Claudia Roden has been called an historian, a storyteller, a cultural anthropologist, but she prefers simply a food enthusiast. She's been writing about food for 60 years, publishing 11 books. She was born in Egypt, moved to Paris for school. She then settled in London in her early 20s, and that's where she's still based. When she visited the Earth Eats studio this fall, I wanted to learn about her food life growing up. In Egypt, who was doing the cooking in your house?
We had a cook. We were Jews, and we were Jews from Syria and from Turkey on one side. We cooked different kinds of food. We were also very Europeanized. We spoke French at home and Italian because we had Italian nannies. All of us had Italian nannies, but the cooks were people from the villages, were always men, and they came from Upper Egypt. They had no idea how people cooked in Cairo, where I lived. So the women had to teach the cooks. And the cooks got to be better than them in the end, because they also stayed forever. That was the pattern. And they also, all the cooks were at the top cooking for themselves. They were given money to cook what they liked. And it was different from what they cooked in our homes.
So let's go back then to 1968, your first book, a book of Middle Eastern food. So I want to just talk about the process of collecting recipes for that book. What did you do to get the food that you put in that book?
Yes. Well, in 1956, when I was an art student in London, all of a sudden, because of the Suez War between Egypt and France, England, and Israel, the three countries had attacked Egypt. In retaliation, Gamal Abdel Nasser threw out all the Jews because Israel had taken part. And myself in London, suddenly my parents joined us. Myself and my two brothers. And for the next 20 years, we kept having floods, really. We were inundated by Jews from Egypt who had become refugees. And at that time, one thing that everybody was asking, apart from, have you heard from so-and-so, have you heard from so-and-so, everybody was exchanging recipes and saying, I'll never see you again. Can you give me the recipe for all that chocolate cake? And people also said, I'll give you my recipe because I want you to remember me. So there was this frantic or passionate exchange of recipes, which never happened before. In Egypt, everybody was jealous of their recipes. All the women were rivals about how they cooked. And then suddenly now this was something. And to me, it became something really important and relevant. And I just started taking note of everybody's recipe. That's how I started. I was just 20 when it happened, and my mother was 45. They were mostly women my mother's age, and they were saying my mother and my grandmother. So I guess many of the recipes would have been from the 19th century. And I have to say that's what people are cooking today in London.
I'm so struck by this idea of I'm never going to see you again. Have this recipe so that you'll never forget me.
Yes.
I'm so struck by that. So they really thought that this was an integral part of how they define themselves, these dishes.
Exactly. It was really, that's when I realized that food was not just a dish for sustenance, not just for pleasure, but it meant so much more. It meant identity. It meant roots.
So then you're so much more than a cookbook writer if you're collecting these recipes that people are so touched by and connect with so deeply. You had to somehow personalize them and put the person into the recipe. Is that true?
I had to do that. And at that time in Britain and in London, in particular, people were not interested in food at all. Food was just not a subject. It was even a taboo subject. And if I asked people what they cooked or I told them what they cooked, I had a look of horror and embarrassment. And when I told them it was about Middle Eastern recipes that I was collecting, they would say, oh, is that eyeballs and testicles?
Oh my God. A logistical question about writing a cookbook. As you're collecting recipes, did you get proportions and measurements from people?
No, they didn't have them. It was by looking and by feel that you learned. It wasn't by reading. And people would tell me the kind of thing, for instance, for a dough. They would say, put as much flour as it takes. And I was saying, how much could it take? How do I know? And they would say things like, well, while you're doing, when you start working the dough with your hand, with one hand, with the other hand, feel the lobe of your ear. And when it feels the same, then that's how much it takes. That's it.
But you have recipes with proportions. So did you try out all these recipes?
I tried every single recipe.
And so you say, okay, a half teaspoon of cumin and three cups of flour.
Yes, and very often I think that they were more right than we are, as you
know. Just doing it by feel.
Yes, because the flour, flours are all vary. But even flours made from wheat that grow in the same field, every year they absorb a different amount of water. So how much it takes is in a way sensible.
Claudia Roden, cookbook author, she calls herself a food writer, cultural anthropologist, historian, storyteller, whatever you want to call her. She's written 11 cookbooks. What a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak.
Claudia Roden is one of the foremost writers on Jewish food. She's written the Book of Middle Eastern Food and the Book of Jewish Food. She was in the Earth Eats studios last fall. Coming up from the Bloomington Community Farmers Market,
We really focus on soil health and soil fertility, and the healthier your soil is, the better your produce tastes and the better it is for you. It's more nutritious. So we really focus on soil to create good tasting, healthy produce.
Rosie Sill is one of the voices in our farmer montage. Hear it in about 5 minutes. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Homemade cheese, let's do it. Robin Morton teaches basic dairy making at the White Violet Center for Eco-Justice at St. Mary of the Woods, Indiana. She's got a gallon of milk heating up right now. Paneer, she says, is easy to make and it's delicious. Follow along as she makes it.
When we're going to make paneer, we're going to wait for the milk to actually boil. Then we're going to put the acid in. And because of that, you're going to get these big lumpy curds, these big, like you could hold them, gigantic curds that we're then going to press into a cheese. So I'm just going to pour, I just add lemon juice, usually about a third of a cup or so is what I like to use. But what I want to do is I want to bring it back up to a boil. And what that's going to do is it's going to sort of force the curds to come together a bit more, sort of stick together, get it real hot. This is probably the only cheese I am aware of where it involves actually purposefully boiling it. Most other cheeses, you don't really want to do that. But this one you do. And this really is starting to look like cottage cheese. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get myself some butter muslin over here. Yeah. Get it wet. Nice big piece of cheesecloth. Huge piece. The bigger the cheesecloth, the better. Trust me. There is no worse feeling than gathering up the sides of the cheesecloth and lifting it up and realizing that it was narrow here and then it all just pours. Aww. Oh, you're just like, really? I'm gonna pour this in. very hot. Be careful. You want to mess with this when it's still pretty darn hot, because while it's hot, you can get it to stick together better. I want to make this into a block, something that I can cut. So I've got a rubber band right here. I am going to try to get this as tight as I reasonably can without actually breaking or ripping the cloth. Now, this is a steamer from a wok. I love using this just because it gives me a flat bottom and get a nice flat even cheese. But since most people don't have that, you can put this into the bottom of a colander, something like anything it can drain out of. And then you want to put something on top of it to press it. And those curds are going to come together and form a solid block that hopefully I can cut.
We had to wait for the curds to cool, and sure enough, Robin Morton was able to cut up pieces for us to try. Amazing. And you can put it in Daniel Orr's recipe for Indian Sog, if you like. All sorts of recipes at eartheats.org.
We have tulips and lots of potted flowers and baskets. There's popcorn.
Even in early spring, the Bloomington Community Farmers Market was full of things to buy. Robin Hobson is the market master. We're going back in time to the first day of this season's market. We chatted with some growers who are looking ahead to a promising market season, and we bring you this audio postcard.
From last season, like flowers and cured things like sweet potatoes and squash.
Let's start off with 12-year-old Rance Stout.
Oh, I'm sending out sorghum samples.
How am I going to use sorghum in my cooking?
You can use it pretty much like honey. Some people put it in their coffee. She makes sorghum cookies.
Mom, what do you think about that?
Oh, it's nice to have just a day one-on-one with my son. So, and he's a good help. He enjoys the plants and he enjoys visiting with people.
I've got grass-fed beef and free-range hen's eggs. The farms in eastern Greene County and the cows are on pasture 12 months a year. They do have access to the barn when the weather's poor. They're strictly on pasture. We feed them hay in the winter. We finish in the summer. They've got a good life.
All our soaps are 20% milk that we hand milk from our goats and cows, and then we also use herbs that we grow. Our most popular is the lavender soap. It's just a classic, good, clean scent. People just love the ground lavender buds that we put in there with the milk.
My name's Chad, and we're Blue Mush. We cultivate mushrooms locally and urbanly. Right now we're indoor, but we've also got a shiitake hut in the works, so hopefully we'll be coming on strong with shiitakes as the summer progresses. Yeah, well, we saw that it kind of lacked some mushrooms sometimes, so we thought we'd kind of fill the gap, and we've been having a lot of fun doing it. We've got good space and a lot of knowledge and equipment to do it, so we're here to stay.
This is Earth Song Farm. And we are selling beets and greens mix and spinach. We really focus on soil health and soil fertility. And the healthier your soil is, the better your produce tastes and the better it is for you. It's more nutritious. So we really focus on soil to create good tasting, healthy produce.
My wife and I, we've been coming to the market since 1996. So it's just kind of part of us now. It's such a great market. We're here so much, we don't really get to visit other markets. But from what we hear, this is one of the best, and we love it.
Jeff Padgett there. Before him, Rosie Sill of Earthsong Farm. Chad Powers is a mushroom farmer. Grace McNeil is based in Gosport, Indiana. And our youngest farmer who started it all off, Rance Stout. If you're buying up the last few ears of fresh corn at the market, consider preserving them to enjoy into December and January. I spoke with our resident preservation expert, Amy Jean Roy, to get some suggestions. I caught her in the kitchen in the middle of a huge canning project.
Well, my husband found someone who had 4 more boxes of tomatoes, so I canned 30 pounds.
Amy uses a bit of an unusual recipe when she's preserving corn. She says it goes against everything you've been taught about canning.
But it works. I use it year after year. It's so easy that I like to use it as a beginner recipe for a lot of the younger people are asking, oh, how do I get started doing all, you know, putting food up for the winter? I'll say, hey, the corn's going right now. Why don't you cut it off the cob and do this to it? It's just a good beginner recipe for starting to put things away. Not so daunting as some people think canning can be.
What you'd do normally to preserve corn is you blanch the ears, then shock them in cold water, slice the kernels off the cob, put that and the corn liquid into a canning jar, heat it up to just about simmering, then freeze it. Jean Roy's recipe, on the other hand, is much simpler. Cut fresh corn off the cob, mix it with water, sugar, and salt, and bag it up, and you're done. And her family seems to like it. She uses this corn in a variety of ways in her cooking over the winter months.
For our family, I like to freeze it in 4 cups in a bag for some of it, because that I use in my corn chowder or my fish chowder, potato, any kind of cream-based soup. And then for 2-cup batches, that's just a side dish. So all you would do is take it out of the freezer, thaw it, and heat it up, and it's ready to serve.
Check out Amy Jean Roy's blog post about this rebel method for preserving corn. Let us know if it works for you as well as it does for her. Read the post and write a comment at eartheats.org. Corn still on the ears. Chef Bob Atkins has a few on the grill today, and he's mixing up a Mexican sauce to spoon on top. Let's see what he's up to.
Okay, so we're going to start with about 1/2 cup of sour cream. 1/2 cup of mayonnaise. You can use, you know, regular mayonnaise. You could use light mayonnaise if you want, no fat mayonnaise. In that, we're going to put some grated Parmesan, some fresh grated Parmesan right off the giant wheel. Garlic chili paste. It's the red sriracha style stuff. If you don't have the chili paste, you can use sriracha. About 1/2 lime juiced into there also. A little bright citrus note. We're going to use some cilantro, very classic Central American Mexican herb. Take a whisk to it. This is going to add a really rich coating to your grilled corn, which should be getting pretty close. And I don't know if you can hear it or not.
That's popping. The corn is popping.
It is popping. And it's okay if you get a little charred on one side. You can just leave it out. It bounces out on the other side. You just want to get some nice color to it. Like I said, if you've steamed in advance, you just want to get a little bit of the caramelization to it. You can get it as dark as you want, or you can leave it as light as you want. It also burns off a lot of those little hairs that might have slipped through your fingers during the shucking process. Okay, so we're going to spoon a little bit over the top, and that is your Mexican-style grilled corn.
Let us know how you use this sauce over corn or over veggies or fish. Write a comment on the post at eartheats.org. Lots of love for our crew, Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and a special thanks to audio engineer Casey Zakin. Oh, and of course, the folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Great stuff. Thanks for being here today. I'm Annie Corrigan. Cheers.